This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, Dr. Peter Carey is an Emeritus Fellow at Trinity College, Oxford University, and a visiting professor in University of Indonesia's Faculty of Humanities. Peter is here in Malaysia to deliver a public lecture at the Jeffrey Chia Distinguished Speaker Series on the Uses and Abuses of History, a British Historian's View of Southeast Asia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Peter. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
You know, you were born and raised in Rangoon, what is now known as Yangon, and what was your family upbringing like, and what brings you to this part of the world? I understand you have a certain, you're very attracted somehow to this part of the world. How is that, Peter?
Well, obviously, I had a family who made their lives in Asia. My mother was born in Shanghai and from a family that had been three generations in China. And my father sailed down the Mersey when he was 21 and was sent out by his Liverpool import-export company, Fairweather Richards, to open a branch of their company in Rangoon, which was the name which Yangon had in colonial time. And he remained there really for most of his working life. I mean, he walked out of Burma in 1942 when the Japanese came, and he met my mother in Quetta. She was the librarian of the staff college, and he was sent to Quetta to train as a staff officer. And then they came back and remade their lives in Burma after the war. And from my father's side, actually, he has an ancestor, William Carey, who was the first Baptist missionary in India. And he translated the Bible into 27 different Indian languages and was the person to open the first press in Calcutta.
Wow. And you live in Indonesia today.
Yeah, I live in Indonesia.
How did you land in Indonesia?
Well, Indonesia was a sort of curious serendipity, really, because I studied in Oxford, and at the end of my time in Oxford, I was on a borderline between a first and a second class honours degree. I prepared for the interview, which everybody had to have in order to test whether they were suitable to go up or to remain down. And while I was preparing for the test, the chairman of the Board of Examiners turned up while I was having a drink with my tutor. And he said, well, I'm not telling tales out of school, Peter, but if you do well tomorrow, you can get a first. And if you get a first, you'll get an automatic grant from the government to do research.
That's a lot of pressure.
Right. So what would you like to do with your research? And I said, well, that's simple. That's easy, because Richard Cobb was such a wonderful tutor on French history and the history of the French Revolution. I will do something on maybe the regional reactions to the French Revolution. And he said, well, don't do that. That's a very oversubscribed field. But I've just come back from The Hague in Holland, where I saw all the papers of Marshal Dindels, who was the only non-French marshal who was sent by Napoleon to basically reform the administration and defend Java against the British. Why don't you do something on the impact of the revolution overseas, Java? So I thought, well, that's amazing. That's interesting. And in fact, I just won an English-speaking Union scholarship to study at Cornell in the United States. And they had a simply marvelous Southeast Asia program. So everything really went from that curious piece of serendipity on Balliol Lawn.
Wow. And whatever you learned about Indonesia and, you know, whatever happened with the Javanese time, you know, you have a special interest in Prince Diponegoro.
Diponegoro.
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, it's one of the ruses of history. You know, I started in Cornell and I was learning Dutch. And I started with the idea of doing Dindels. And basically what the professors in Cornell said was that, well, colonial history is not our stock in trade. But if you're interested in Dindels, first learn Dutch and then learn Indonesian and then learn Javanese and look at him from the grassroots upwards. So I began that process of learning the languages. And when I was learning Dutch, suddenly, one day, I took a chapter at a time, or a page at a time, my eye fell on this print of this rather weary figure in the center of his lance-bearing bodyguard coming into the prepared encampment in the Progo River to prepare for his negotiations with the Dutch, which would end in this treachery on the end of the fasting month on the Hari Raya Idul Fitri. And I thought, gosh, that's a very, you know, as the Chinese say, a glance is worth a thousand words. And that glance suddenly brought me into contact with this figure, which I found deeply fascinating.
And all that study that you've done on Indonesian history, How does that reflect on the people of Indonesia today? I mean, is contemporary Indonesia a society that has forgotten its history, or do they connect very much with their history?
I think they connect in various, very personal ways. Obviously, they're intensely interested in their family genealogy and where their families came from. There is a deep root, I think, of, you know, historical awareness. The problem is that because of the way in which Indonesia has developed since Merdeka, since independence, the facility for supporting research, which is expensive, you know, I mean, if you're doing research, you're probably not going to be productive in a business or commercial sense for a lot of your life. I mean, you're going to be producing big books, but it's a sort of lost leader in terms of, you know, developing a country. So the ability to actually develop a research base has been very fitful. And there's also been the problem of regime, particularly under the Suharto regime, a particular vision of history. Well, first of all, you have the Dutch legacy, and the Dutch history is written by the winners. And the winners in the colonial time were the Dutch, and they wrote their history. And, of course, they wrote Diponegoro out of it and said, well, he only rebelled because he was a frustrated dynast. He wanted to become sultan. And he rebelled for a pittance. You know, basically, we wanted to enlarge the road by his estate, and he took umbrage at that and just rebelled. So the basic, deeper socioeconomic issues were not dealt with at all by the Dutch. And then in the post-independence period, you had obviously Sukarno, and he used history very effectively, but it was to some extent propagandized. And then you had it even more so under the New Order, which looked at a particular vision of history, which was very militaristic, and everything that was not, didn't fit into that picture, was sort of really not allowed. It wasn't national history. I mean, I had to cancel a lecture in the Universitas 11 Maret in Solo, which was set up by Ibu Tien Soeharto, not because I was talking about contemporary issues, but because I was talking about the early 19th century, and I was quoting from the Javanese Babads, the Javanese Chronicles, very critical remarks about corruption, which was Rajalela, you know. I mean, Tunggak Jarak Merajak, Tunggak Jati Lampus, which said, you know, the teak tree died, so to speak, and the castor oil plant flourished because good people and true were replaced by intruding upstarts. And that was deemed not acceptable.
Peter, is it almost certain when governments get their hands on history, it risks being distorted?
I think everywhere it is distorted. I mean, I had a friend who worked in SOAS, the School of Oriental African Studies Library, when Haile Miriam Mengistu, the colonel, Marxist colonel, took power and executed Haile Selassie in Ethiopia. And he ordered all his students, Ethiopian students in London, to borrow the maximum number of books, which they could, which were non-Marxist, and burn them. So that basically all trace of non-Marxist history on Abyssinia, Ethiopia, could be expunged. I mean, that's a very grotesque, it's what, like the Nazis did with Kristallnacht. But basically, it's this issue of trying to fit history into a particular mold and to have a particular support for, you know, a vision of the regime, which is extremely deleterious and very, very baneful in terms of the health of the Socratic inquiry, which basically has to underpin all historical endeavor.
You argue that a people that forgets its own history not only loses its culture, but exposes itself to huge dangers. What do you mean by that?
Well, let's take the tsunami in Aceh. Tsunamis are not rare in Indonesia. Between 1899, when there was a major tsunami in Seram, in eastern Indonesia, in Maluku, until the Pangandaran in West Java, which was 2006, and the Bantul earthquake, there have been major tsunamis probably once every 80 years, and there have been pretty major events once every 40 to 50 years. So it lives on a seismic zone, yeah? And in fact, between the Australasian and the Indian Asiatic plates, that area of tension, that area of overlap between these two huge plates which undergird the Earth's surface. Off the west coast of Sumatra, there is a major decompression area. And along that, you have a situation in which the Australian plate is breaking up. Yeah, because you have the Himalayas, which don't permit the northern plate to move, and you have 5.8 centimeters of movement from the south every year. So this is a situation, this is a reality. But when the tsunami struck in Aceh on the 26th of December 2004, and it's going to be the 10th anniversary in a few days' time, nearly 150,000 people died in Aceh. But off the west coast of Aceh, 150 nautical miles to the west, at Simolewe, a small island with 70,000 people, only 5 people died. And they died. They were able to save everybody because they had a folk memory, folk history, and very vivid oral tradition, which meant that people knew what to do when an earthquake struck and when the tide began to go out preternaturally. They didn't go and find fish, as people did in Aceh. They went straight up to the mountains. 5 people died in the initial earthquake, but all the rest were saved. And that is an example, for me, of what happens when you lose contact with the vitality of your oral history, which actually connects you to ancient wisdom. And we're living on a very dynamic planet, yeah? And if you don't understand, that basically pretty major seismic events are going on, you're going to be constantly exposed to danger.
We'll come back and find out more about the uses and abuses of history. If you have a question for Dr. Peter Carey, just send it through. Our text messaging number is 016-201-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio. Up next, have we all become too frivolous about history, is what I'd like his input on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Mira Sivasuthi, visiting Professor, Faculty of Humanities, University of Indonesia, Dr. Peter Carey, in the studio with me. We're discussing the uses and abuses of history. Peter's actually giving a talk tonight at the Jeffrey Chia Distinguished Speaker Series. Tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. at Sunway University's Lecture Theatre 4. And if you'd like to meet him in person, he's already impressed me terribly. Peter, have you done much work with Malaysia and Malaysian history?
A little bit. Well, obviously, I'm involved as an Indonesianist with the Malay world. And this is part of the Malay world. And but for the accident of history, it would have still been a dynamic, united, and interacting world. Yeah, and I think that what the Europeans have done is to artificially split that. If you look at the era of Srivijaya, you look at the era of Majapahit, you look even at the 18th century, I mean, the best krisis were made in Java, and people from the Malay archipelago would go to Java to study in the Pesantren and to get their pusaka. So this is a world which has had this interaction. And if the British hadn't been so stupid as to give Java back to the Dutch in 1815, everything from Afghanistan to New Zealand would be a swathe of basically English-speaking zone, and you would have had a situation in which the Malay world wouldn't have been broken up in this artificial fashion. And to draw a line down the Malacca Strait between Sumatra and the peninsula Malaya is just crazy, because basically, if you look at Negeri Sembilan, you look at Selangor, you look at Perak, you look at Johor, I mean, they went to West Sumatra to get their lustration ceremonies, to get their inauguration of their monarchs. You know, that there's been a very long interaction. And this, caesura, which has been brought about by the Europeans, is completely artificial.
Have we become too frivolous about history?
I think that there is a space for, 1066 and all that, and, to have jokes about history.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's pretty important, because if you don't know your history, you're going to miss a lot of tricks. Let me just give you one example. Indonesia fought for its independence. It wasn't like Malaya. It didn't get it on a golden platter. It didn't get it in the rays of the full moon. It got it in the beam of the and the sweat of the sun, yeah? And when Indonesia was fighting for its independence, it actually had to destroy Dutch arguments, because the Dutch said to the United Nations, Indonesia is a Japanese creation. It's complete Di Adadakan. It's something which has just been conjured up out of thin air. It doesn't have any substance. Yeah. And people like Sukarno and Sharia and Hatta are just Japanese puppets. And Sharia went to the United Nations in August of 1947 at a very critical juncture. I mean, the Dutch had just launched their first police action operation product, had taken back all the most productive lands of their former colony. And he went before the United Nations, and he, in a speech of 2 hours, destroyed the Dutch arguments by going back to Majapahit and Sriwijaya and meticulously going through what made Indonesia a coherent entity. And from that moment, Indonesia was seated in the debates on the Indonesian question. It eventually became a United Nations member, full member. And by the time the Dutch launched their second police action on the 19th of December 1948, world opinion was already already gone in the direction of Indonesia. They'd won the diplomatic battle. And in the Senate, in the United States Senate, in February of 1949, a motion was passed to cut the Dutch out of Marshall Aid from fiscal 50-51. And basically, that was the clincher. They said, if you don't go back to the negotiating table, if you don't come to a deal with the Republic, we are not going to give you any more aid. Yeah? So, knowing your history, I mean, Sharia wasn't a professional historian. He was a politician. But he used his history extremely effectively. And when there was confrontasi, you had this confrontation, which the Tunku also spoke about the historical antipathy with Majapahit. Yeah? So as a politician, as someone who is in a leadership position, you are very, very vulnerable if you don't understand history. And in the period when it was the most desperate for us in the UK, the fact that we called all the Spitfire engines, Railroad Spitfire engines, Merlin engines, you know, we went back to King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, we revived Henry V. You know, these archetypes, when you have your back to the wall, are vital.
But why do we need to be careful about how we engage with the past?
Well, we need to be careful. I mean, I have an example of it because the work which I did on Diponegoro was hijacked by the recent election in Indonesia because the losing candidate, Prabowo Subianto, actually used his family's past to project an image of himself which linked him with Diponegoro and the Diponegoro War. And I was asked to make an educational documentary, and I spoke for 90 minutes. And at the end of the educational documentary, which Fadlizon made, and he was his deputy secretary general of the Gerindra Party, he asked me two questions about the Joyadikusumo relatives. And I mentioned these people. One of them was disabled. He became the first Pribumi historian of the Java War and was extremely outspoken about corruption, the corruption of the Dutch and the Javanese who supported them before the war. And the other was a junior commander who went into rebellion. And I said these were not yes men. These were people of principle and moral integrity. And then that was twisted, and it seemed that I was talking when the film, Prabowo Sang Patriot, Prabowo the Patriot, was made. I was not talking about the Java War. I was not talking about their relatives 5 generations beforehand, but I was talking about Prabowo, and they actually put me on the Gerindra website. And that is, it's not only unethical, but it's also a form of manipulation of history, which is extremely dangerous. And it's also dangerous when you try and mine your history for gems, as it were. So if you look at the history of the Joyadikusumo family, it's true. They had relatives who fought in the Java War. That's not made up. But if you try and mine your history, Prabowo's mother came from a very prominent Minahasan, North Sulawesi family from Manado, the Sigar family. And her great-grandfather, Benjamin Thomas Sigar, was a captain of the Hooptroepen, which were the allied the levies, the native levies, who fought for the Dutch and helped win the Java War. And he's actually depicted in Peenemann's great portrait of the submission of Diponegoro to General de Kock in Magalang on the 28th of March, 1830. So on the one hand, you have a legacy of heroism. On the other hand, you have a legacy of cooperation. And, you know, it's history is never simple. It's very jagged. It's very complex. It's that is the delight about history, and that's a challenge of it. But if you try and mine it politically, it's extremely dangerous.
But should we challenge certainties about the past, even when it might be painful?
All the time, you have to do that. So the first thing that AJP Taylor told me when I sat down as a research fellow at Magdalen, a prize fellow, in February 1974, when I had my induction dinner, he asked me who my supervisor was. And I said, my supervisor was this eccentric man, Richard Collar. And he said, that's really dangerous, because he has no doubt. And a historian has to, that's the primary default setting. It's like the Buddha said, you know, disbelieve my words 50%. You've got to make this your own. It's got to be Dara Dugging, yeah? And the only way you can do that is by actually inquiring. Doubt everything. Have a question mark, yeah? No source is, you know, like a sort of hostage, yeah? You've got to be able to say, well, how did this come about? Why did this come about? And if you look at Indonesian history, I can give you just one example. One example is happened in my own hometown, Oxford, that home of lost causes and impossible loyalties. Yeah, Matthew Arnold. The mayor, Mohammed Abbasi, a UK citizen of Pakistani descent, decided to recognize the West Papua independence movement. And he did that by ordering that on the 1st of December, which is the date when West Papua was given its independence by the Dutch, the Morning Star flag should fly from the mayor's offices and the Hotel de Ville, the municipal centre of Oxford. Well, you know, that's his right, but why aren't the Indonesian diplomats in London bending a path to Oxford to actually argue this case at the Oxford Union? Because they have something to stand on, unlike East Timor, which was an act of aggression. This was part of the patrimony of the Dutch East Indies, and they should be able to make a case. But because they are not Pede, they're not, Percaya Diri, Dalam Hal Sejarah, they can't, you know, believe in themselves. They are hamstrung about really batting for Indonesia and you know, carrying the cause of the Indonesian government to the bowels of Oxford and coming to the Union and arguing their case and winning a debate in open. Sharia would have done it. Sukarni, who took Sukarno at gunpoint to Rangkas Dengklok to say, you've got to declare independence now, 15th of August. Japanese have collapsed. Within 2 weeks, you're going to have the Allies here. Unless you make this independence now, you've got 72 hours to do it. Unless you do it now, it's going to be gone. So you have, there is a tide in the affairs of men. If taken at the flood, leads on to greatness. If missed, all one's life is lived in miseries. And that's the case with historians and with the historical reality.
Now, remind me, why didn't somebody like you teach me history in school? Man, I would have loved the topic. You know, and which brings me to, are we teaching history all wrong in schools?
Well, the problem with history is it's become like a sort of mathematical formula. You've got to learn all these dates. But history is about human beings. It's about, I mean, you know, I've got a very 3D imagination and I see things in glorious technicolor, and I could have been a filmmaker, but I find history much more interesting because actually, fact is much more complex and bizarre than fiction. Yeah. There's a wonderful book which won the Man Booker Prize, which is a novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. And that, for me, is just a wonderful way in which you can use history, the history of Weary Wilmot, that surgeon who saved so many lives and was this, you know, Oscar Schindler-type womanizer and, you know, sort of full of complexities. And this is placed in the most vivid and marvelous context, which is so real, because the writer has done his work on the history and the context.
How did you fall in love in, you know, wanting to study modern history at Oxford?
Well, I think I had the most wonderful tutors. And
see, that makes a difference.
Yeah, and they set me these Zen koans on what if, you know, why this
challenging.
Happened. Challenging, mm-hmm. yeah. When I was a 15-year-old, I had my essays torn up if I didn't go to the original sources and actually write the histories from the original, not the manuscripts, but the published manuscripts. And that taught me about the need for integrity and the need for not to plagiarize or not, you know, to come up with your own views. And if you do that, you've got a very important resource. You've got a very important... It's like, it's a skill. It's a bit like someone who's a complain, wonderful teak furniture. You know, it's, this is, yeah, you've got to have batik tulis, not batik chap with history.
So there is no best way to teach history as such then?
I think you've got to make it come alive in the imaginations and lives of your pupils, and you've got to set them on fire. Education is about leading out.
Yeah, that is a challenge indeed. You really need to be, you know, into history, in history to understand it. How do we use narratives about the past in the construction of a collective identity?
Well, I think that's going on all the time. Yeah, when the Pergerakan Nasional started in Indonesia, there was a story which was told about what had happened to Indonesia under colonialism and what would happen when you had Merdeka, which was the golden bridge to a socialist paradise or to whatever would happen after Merdeka. And I think, you know, everybody lives their lives with a certain story. I have a certain story with my life. I mean, I have a story of a family that lived in Asia and, you know, I have my parents and I have my own story I tell myself about being an Englishman who has a second identity. That's what Richard Cobbin pressed on me, said that any historian has to have a second identity and has to feel completely at home in the society, culture, and time in which they study and live. And unless you're telling stories about yourself, I mean, if you're living in a totally hedonistic and this worldly and this present moment, you've got no resources. If you look at Germany, I mean, Germany went back to a pre-Reich imperial past to rebuild itself, and it's now become an extremely successful democracy. 75% of its energy comes from recycled energy. And it's done that by looking at the past. My father's family come from Ireland. And, you know, over three generations since the independence war between 1916 and 21, a lot of work was done on basically looking at what had actually happened until you have a form of closure, which happened when Queen Elizabeth, the Queen, went to Ireland between the 17th and 20th of May 2011. First visit for 100 years. Her father, grandfather, George V, had been there in 1911. And there was closure. She went to all the places where there had been Pembantéan, when there'd been massacres, Crow Park, where the British had opened fire and shot, you know, 14 and wounded 65 while watching a Gaelic football match. All the Garden of Remembrance, all the places which were drowned in blood in this time. 800 years of history. And we've now got a form of closure. And I know this because the East Timorese set up their foreign office and they got in touch with a friend of mine in Dublin and said, we're going to play the British off against the Irish. We're going to have a embassy in Dublin and we're going to have an embassy in London. And we're going to also have a representative at the Vatican. And we had to tell them, sorry, mate, it's finished. It doesn't work anymore. It's not like that. Yeah. So if you confront your past, you have to confront your past. If you don't confront the past, you have what happened in Austria with Kurt Waldheim. Yeah. You have a situation in which you have a conjuring trick in which Austria pretends to be the first victim of Nazism with the Anschluss in March of 1936. And yet it has its own concentration camps, Mauthausen. It has a particularly vicious form of anti-Semitism, much better anti-Semites than the Nazis, maybe worse Nazis. And at the end of the war, you know, you wave a magic wand and they're, you know, at one bound, they're free. But you haven't confronted your history, and that comes back. And it comes back in a very painful way during the Waldheim presidency, the ninth president between 86 and 92. And you have Simon Wiesenthal and others digging into this. He may not have been a war criminal, but as a young lieutenant assigned to Army Group E in the Balkans, he was privy to the mass massacre of Serbs. And to say he didn't know it is a lie. And you have a president, head of state, who has to lie to be able to hold his head up. And when he died alone, and only two countries sent a wreath. One was Japan, and the other was Bulgaria.
What's your message to all of us Malaysians as far as history is concerned?
I think it's to have the courage of your convictions and to look at your past, to look at May of 1969, to actually confront your past and to have space in your society to speak truth to power. Because if you don't have that space and people are cowed intellectually, you are going to have a craven society.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Peter Carey, Visiting Professor, Faculty of Humanities, University of Indonesia, on the uses and abuses of history. He's actually presenting this talk at the Jeffrey Chia Distinguished Speaker Series tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. at Sunway University's Lecture Theatre 4. You want to catch him there. I definitely will. Thank you very much for joining us. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.